Amen. Buckle up. We're making it through today. We're plowing through. So get out Matthew chapter 2, and we're not messing around. Sound like fun? Great fun, Shane. Okay. We made it to verse 4, I think. Something like that. So I'm going to start in verse 1 of chapter 2. I'm going to start reading and just start commenting. So I will wait, though, until you're ready, because we're going to be cruising. Tell me when. You ready? I got the nod from Corbin. That means we're all ready. Here we go. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem, so notice right there we've jumped about 2 years, in Judea, during the time of King Herod, King, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born of the King of the Jews? We saw a star in the east and have come to worship him." Let me stop right there real quick. I do want to say this. I promise I'm not going to stop track. Another reason why Herod may be a little bit nervous is because of the overemphasis on the east aspect. The key Roman enemy throughout the history of Rome is known as the Parthians, and they dwell in the land that is east, east of the Euphrates, which would be kind of the area of the Babylonians. The Parthians were vicious in war. I mean vicious. Matter of fact, they had perfected riding on horseback and shooting bows and arrows, which was a very incredible and agile way of fighting. A lot of times they were called cowards because whenever they would fight, what they would do is a lot of times they would charge in, they would have a little bit of hand-to-hand combat, then they would immediately retreat, and as they're retreating, they'd shoot behind them on their horses. And the Romans hated it and did everything they could to shame them, but the Parthians didn't care because they were picking off Romans left and right when they were just riding away. The Parthians, though, became amazing. Major threat, especially in the first century. And whenever you heard ruminations of the fact that the Parthians from the east may be teaming up with somebody to come against Rome, it was a major issue in the city of Rome. As a matter of fact, whenever Nero died in 68, there were rumors that he was not really dead, kind of like an Elvis situation there. He's not really dead. He's going to come back, but when he comes back, it's going to be with the Parthians. And when the Parthians come with Nero, that's going to be, you know, some people would say that it was the demise of Rome itself. Herod had a little bit of issue with the Parthians in the first century BC. When Herod was trying to secure his place, in the Civil War, I won't go into it too much, but one of the guys ends up teaming up with the Parthians to fight against Herod. Herod in 37 runs to Rome and asks them, "Hey, please bail me out because the Parthians are teaming up with this guy." Rome does. He secures his position. So the way in which he dealt with the paranoia of the Parthians teaming up with someone was quite hostile. As a matter of fact, he built all kinds of temples on the edge of his empire just to protect from the Parthians coming with somebody. So whenever the Magi are coming from the east and they're finding a king, he could be thinking also, "Oh boy, allegiance is forming to come back and get me again." Do you see where the paranoia could come? There's history behind the east, and that Herod would, well, the next verse, when King Herod heard about this, he was disturbed. Understatement. And all Jerusalem with him. Verse 4. When he called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. Do you notice something weird there, what he asks, as opposed to what the Magi came looking for?
He asked for the Christ.
Yeah. He asked for the Christ, but what did they come looking for? The king. That should tell us something about the word Christ. It is not a last name. It is not a last name. It is the anointed king of Israel. They come asking for a king, the king of the Jews, and he says naturally that means the Christ. So he asked them, where is he supposed to be born? To which they respond in verse 5, in Bethlehem in Judea. They replied, for this is what the prophet has written. That sounds interesting or familiar, right? What is that?
Fulfillment.
Yeah, fulfillment formula. Remember? Now it's coming, though, not from the mouth of Matthew, technically. It's coming from the mouth of the chief priests and the teachers of the law. For this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people, Israel. More than likely, this comes from two specific passages. The first and primary one is clearly Micah chapter 5, verses 2 through 5. Now, obviously, I'm going to be asking the question of context whenever we come to an Old Testament passage that's been referenced, right? Right? Wonderful scholars of ours that are in training, yes? Context, important word. Important concept. What's happening in Micah whenever this passage happens? Well, I have the answer for you. Chapter 1 and 2, Micah's pronouncing judgment on Jerusalem and Samaria because of their rebellion, because of their absolute disregard of the statutes of God. Chapter 3, he's rebuking the prophets and the leaders for leading the people down this path of rebellion. Chapter 4 comes, and you start to see that God, even in the midst of their rebellion, which this is a very prophetic thing to do, he constantly, usually prophets are hammering on the fact there's rebellion, rebellion. This is how you have betrayed God's covenant. This is what you have done. Curses all over the place. And then they say, and yet, there is a plan for your restoration. And in Micah chapter 4, that's what you see. God has a plan for his restoration. But in Micah chapter 5, the key to the restoration is given to us. And specifically, the key to that restoration is the Messiah. Now let me read to you Micah chapter 2, or 5, 2 through 5. It says this: "But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." What does that say right off the bat? Where does their hope rest? Where does it reside? Do I need to read it again? "Out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." Where does their hope rest? Son of David. The Messiah. Everybody following me? Just because we're in the Old Testament doesn't mean we get to check out. All right? Okay, let's keep reading from the Old Testament. "Therefore, Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor gives birth, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. He will stand up and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, and he will be their peace." So even though they are pointing to a place, Matthew includes this quote because he's pointing to a person. Do you see what's happening? They're saying, it's from Bethlehem. We know because of Micah chapter 5, 2. And he says, yeah, let's read Micah chapter 5, verse 2. It's not just a place. It's a person we're dealing with here. And who is the person? He's the liberator of all of Israel. He is where they will find their peace. This also, though, is probably talking about 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 2, specifically because of the phrase, "and you will be a shepherd over my people." Whenever Saul has the wars with David, and David finally is instituted king over Israel, the Lord says this in 2 Samuel 5, 2, "And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler." And what happens after that? Well, David takes the throne, he conquers Jerusalem, he defeats the Philistines, and the Ark of the Covenant is brought back. What are both passages emphasizing? What? David. And what is the function of David? Restoration of the kingdom. Restoration of the kingdom. Even from the mouths of the chief priests and the teachers of the law, they are pointing to the text that should be pointing us to a moment of jubilation, because restoration of Israel is on the horizon if the Messiah is to be born. Right? Yes? But what is Herod's reaction? Then, verse 7, "Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared." What is he doing? What? He's planning ahead for what? Yeah, for a strike. Herod's not worried about liberation. Herod's worried about his own political tenure. Why does he call them? The key word in that verse is secretly. Huh? Well, you call them secretly because the people that Herod is over are longing for liberation from the oppression of Rome. Yes? They're longing for it, and the one thing that they have their mind on, kind of, is the Messiah, right? If the Messiah is all of a sudden from Magi from the east proclaiming to be here, and he wants to strike them, what will that cause Herod? A revolt. Just think normal politics. A political uprising would occur. And Herod's head would be what they'd be after. The meeting is secret because Herod's trying to save his own tail. Right? Yes? I keep asking right because some of you seem very tired this morning. Is that okay if I keep asking? Okay, it doesn't matter. I'm going to. All right. Let's keep moving. Verse 8. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." Liar! This is Herod's own great commission. Yeah? As a matter of fact, there's some interesting antithetical parallels between this great commission and Jesus at the end of Matthew chapter 28. First of all, Herod's is based on a lie, where Jesus will be based on the truth of the resurrection and the ascension. Herod's, number two, is for the protection of his kingdom, his own personal kingdom, where Jesus' great commission is for the inception and the advancement of his kingdom. Notice the difference. Herod's trying to hoard his kingdom and protect it from anybody taking it away, and Jesus is trying to set his kingdom free so that it can spread like wildfire. Herod's great commission is for self-preservation. Jesus' great commission comes after he's already died on a cross. Herod's great commission is ignored by the recipients, as we'll see in just a minute, because the Magi don't come back and tell him. Jesus is obeyed. At least the fact that we are here is evidence of that. Number five, Herod's great commission has earthly authority, while Jesus has heavenly.
Can you go through those again?
Yes, most definitely. Herod's great commission is based on a lie. There actually is three great commissions in the Gospel of Matthew, and only one of them comes from Jesus. One of them comes from Herod, and we'll see another one later on in chapter 28 that comes from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They give a great commission to the soldiers that were guarding the tomb. And we'll get to that later. But number one, Herod's is based on a lie, while Jesus' is secured in truth because of the resurrection and ascension. Number two, Herod's is for the protection of his own kingdom, while Jesus is for the advancement of his kingdom. One of them is hoarding their kingdom, one of them is setting the kingdom free. Number three, Herod's great commission is for self-preservation. He wants to save his own tail. That's why he's given him this commission. Because if he can figure out where the Messiah is, he can kill it before anybody knows. Hence, secret meeting. While Jesus' his great commission is given after he's already been crucified. So self-preservation is not the motivation of his commission. Number four, Herod's recipients ignore his great commission, while Jesus' great commission is obeyed. And the evidence of that is you're sitting here, Gentile. Number five, Herod's was based off of earthly authority, and Jesus' wasn't. It was based off of heavenly authority. Actually, that's even an understatement. Jesus' was based off of all authority in heaven and on earth, hence that's what he says in the Great Commission. Right? It's not like that there's heavenly versus earthly. He owns both. Everybody good on those? Need me to repeat one, or are you good? All right, let's keep moving. Verse 9, after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. Really quick. This is, I'm not going to do justice to this, but I missed this yesterday. Some people will ask the question. Some of me thinks this is a superfluous question because it doesn't really matter. But they will ask the question, what is this star that is leading the Magi? And, I'll buy into the curiosity and say this. There's three options. One of them is that it's just a random anomaly. It's just like a supernova or a comet that happened to be going overhead. And we actually have evidence of that, but usually the evidence that we have is a couple years too late. Like we're talking 8 BC and 9 BC and stuff like that. Second option is that it's just like some supernatural star, possible. Third option is, this is the one I usually lean towards, is that it's actually an angel. And the reason why is because, there's angels all over the first two chapters of Matthew, one. Number two, we actually have an Arabic gospel that comes from about the 6th century AD, and it expands the Magi account, and it actually says that an angel that appears as a star was it. And they could be pulling from a tradition that began in the 6th century AD, or they could be pulling one that came from way earlier. Ultimately, though, I think the evidence leans towards that it was probably an angel, but ultimately it doesn't really matter. I think the reason why it's used the word star is because it's trying to make a political statement with the story, because stars were really important when it came to the description of the establishment of a king, whether it be at his birth or whether it be at his ascension to the throne. Short answer? Very confusing? Sound good? Those of you that are right on this passage, though, you'll appreciate that someday. Verse 10. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, notice house, not manger. House. They saw the child, notice child, not infant. We're a couple years beyond. When they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Oh, wait a minute. I said that weird. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. If you're a Jew, what do you immediately think of? What passages would you think of if you see the Magi coming and opening up their gifts to your king? What? Go ahead, keep talking.
Or wasn't it a sacrifice in Exodus?
Okay. In what context? I believe you. I'm serious. Like, I mean, I think you could be onto something.
I don't know. I just remember it referring to it in Exodus.
Okay. Yeah, there's definitely Exodus concepts in this. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you didn't read Exodus by accident, and we're going to be talking about that over the next couple of days. So if you're making a connection with Exodus, don't shy away from it, because more than likely there's something there. What else, though? What other passages? I'll give you a hint. Yes. And what about the Psalms? That's, you know, you're right on the right. Matter of fact, I'll even give you a closer hint. Psalm 72. But it's all over the Old Testament. Think about this. Let's just piece this together. Who are the Magi?
Gentiles.
Gentiles. And what are the Gentiles doing? Coming and bringing what to him? Gifts. As a matter of fact, let's read Psalm chapter, 72 is what I said, right? Yeah, it is. Yeah. Psalm 72, 10 through 11 says this. The kings of Tarshish and of distant shores will bring tribute to him. Who's him? The Messiah. I mean, retrospectively, the Messiah. The kings of Sheba and Seba will present him gifts. All kings will bow down to him, and all nations will serve him. This is a continual theme throughout the Old Testament, is it not? I mean, whether you're talking about Isaiah 65 through 6, Isaiah 60, 11, Isaiah 66, 20, Zephaniah 3:10, Haggai 2, 7 through 8, you can just goes on and on and on. The concept of all of the pagan nations coming to their king and laying down gifts, and at the semi-birth of Jesus, because we're probably a couple years in now, it's happening. The Gentiles are coming and they're laying down the gifts at the feet of the king, which is a precursor of the relationship between the king and the Gentiles to come. This is a major significant event. Matthew never, always ask this question, especially when you're doing an exegetical paper. Always ask the question, why did my gospel include this story? And what would be missing if it was pulled away? They never put a story in by accident. They never just say, oh, remember that one? Let's just throw that one in. They never do that. They are always developing some sort of theological point. They always are. Are you following me here? Think about how many stories they could have told in the 3 years that they knew Jesus. Why did they choose these? I mean, Matthew chooses one that no one else even has. Why? He's making a point about who Jesus is and about what his kingdom does and will be. And it is not a small factor that the Gentiles come and lay down gifts at the feet of this child. And it's not an accident the gifts they lay down. Hear me very clearly, I do not think that the Magi knew what the gifts were, the significance of the gifts were that they were giving him. I don't think that they knew. Exactly. I think they knew that they were dealing with royalty, which is why the gold comes in, because gold is a gift you give to kings. I think they understood that. But I don't think they understood the actual meaning of all the gifts they gave to Jesus. Matter of fact, I don't even think that they just gave him three gifts. I think that's the ones that Matthew listed. Because I think Matthew found significance in these three gifts. You hear what I'm saying in that? You following me? Yes? Holler if you hear me. Okay. I don't think the Magi were going, we're going to give you frankincense, because you see, frankincense is the key ingredient to the recipe that you would put in the incense that you put on the altar that is burned as a sacrifice to God, which has priestly inclinations. And you know, this isn't going to be just a king, it's also going to be a priest. I don't think the Magi went through that, but I think Matthew's going, hey, wait a minute. They did something. I think providentially, God did something here to let us know who Jesus was in the gifts. In myrrh, which actually, you know, the city of Smyrna in Revelation, they think it comes from the same root word of myrrh. But what's interesting about that is that the spice myrrh was used for burial purposes. You would take myrrh and other spices and you would put it in the tomb with the dead rotting corpse so that the putrid smell wouldn't come out of the rocks. That's what you would do with it. Now, it's interesting with these three gifts. Because you have one that could symbolize a king, you have one that could symbolize a priest, and you have one that actually kind of symbolizes the way in which he becomes both. Not bad, huh? Pretty cool. Did the Magi do it on purpose? No. Did Matthew notice something that needed to be said? Absolutely. So he brings it out so that we don't miss it. Moving on. Verse 12. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. We don't know what country it was. More than likely, it was about 900 miles away in the area of Babylon. Verse 13. When they had gone, they being the Magi, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said. Take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. Yes, that's right. Two times in the first 2 weeks I have, or three times, I have PowerPoint. Here we go. Where did they go? Notice where they're at. Where are they at right now? Bethlehem, which is right over, can this work over there? It's not working. Bethlehem, you read it, yay? All right. There's Bethlehem. They're going to be moving into Egypt. Now, this map takes them over here. I don't really know why. We don't really know where they went. More than likely, they end up here in Alexandria. And the reason I say that is because we know at the time that Jesus was born in Alexandria, there was a population of Jews of over a million. It would have been a logical place for them to go. And on this map, it looks a lot farther, but probably would have only been maybe an extra 100 miles, which, I mean, is still far when you're walking. But from Bethlehem just to the border of Egypt is 80. Now, why would they be going to Egypt? What is the significance of them getting into Egypt? Theological significance is huge. Yeah. I mean, my word, Egypt's been a constant factor in the Old Testament. From the time of Joseph, whenever he was sold into imprisonment, and yet he found, in a sense, protection in Egypt. Same thing happens with another figure that's a patriarch, right, that you read about? Where does Moses find protection? In Egypt. And Jesus will as well. There's another reason, though, that's more just political, more logical. That's outside of the jurisdiction of Herod the Great. He has no power in that region. His power stops at the edge of the border of Egypt. Where exactly they went in Egypt, we really don't have any evidence. There's really not good evidence for anywhere in particular. If I had to make a guess, it'd probably be Alexandria, but I wouldn't go to the cross on that because I don't know. The word, though, that is used for kill, to kill, because Herod was going to kill them, is the exact same word that we find in Matthew chapter 27, verse 20, whenever the chief priests and the elders seek a way to kill Jesus. You will notice this all throughout. Matter of fact, if somebody wanted to do a paper on this, I would let them. You will notice that the things that happened at the beginning of Jesus' life will happen again. There are secret meetings at the beginning, and there are secret meetings at the end. There are people that are plotting to kill him, and they're plotting to kill him at the end. There is intentional mirroring throughout Matthew of Jesus' beginning and his end, because he's showing that what he was at the beginning, he was also at the end, namely a king. Blah, 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 blah. Keep reading. We're making it today. We cruising? Oh, yeah, we are. So he got up, he being Joseph, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. Okay, death of Herod. We talked about this some yesterday, didn't we? What happened at the death of Herod? or leading up to and surrounding? Yeah, he killed a bunch. Well, kind of. He did. He killed a bunch of people, but they were all his family. He was killing sons left and right because he had 10 wives and loads of offspring. And he was just lopping them off one because he was so worried and paranoid about who was going to take over his kingdom. What else did he do?
Well, didn't he kill people so they would be in mourning?
He did send out an edict for that to happen. That the leaders of the Jews would be killed whenever he died. But whenever he died, his sister Salome overturned the edict and it never happened. So instead of them dying, there was great jubilation. Because they not only were celebrating the death of a tyrant, they're also celebrating the liberation of their family and their leaders that were going to die. He's a psycho. The death of Herod. Until the death of Herod happens, they're going to stay there. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet. Again, we're going to hear this 7 times in the first 2 chapters. Out of Egypt I called my son. Where is the parallel to that? Anyone know? Say that again. Yeah, he did. Matter of fact, you would think, my logical thought would be, oh, that's in Exodus. But you've read Exodus and it's not in there, is it? That phrase. Right? Is it? No. But the story is in there. This actually comes from Hosea 11. Hosea 11, the sermon yesterday really dealt with Hosea. Hosea in chapter 1 is told to marry a prostitute, an adulterous woman, and I don't know if that was as scandalous as her name, Gomer, but we'll let that one be up for debate. Gracious. The following chapters, though, they describe the punishment and the restoration of Israel using his relationship, Hosea's relationship with Gomer, as a sign act. That's the key word for prophets whenever they're acting out God's intentions for his nation. It's sign acts. It's a sign that is actually enacted. And so, what you see in chapter 2 is you see the punishment and restoration of Israel is enacted in the relationship with Hosea and Gomer. Then you see indictments against Israel in chapter 4, the judgment against Israel in chapter 5, Israel's unrepentant response in chapter 6 and 7, and the punishment against Israel in chapter 9. Now, chapter 11 begins by lamenting what's gone on in chapter 10, or the first 10 chapters. It's like, it doesn't matter what, basically what happens here in the beginning of chapter 11 of Hosea is he says, it doesn't matter what I've done for you. You've always rebelled against me. All the time. And this is how it says. It says, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. What is the most shocking part of that entire phrase? Maybe.
Israel is son.
His son. Jesus calls the nation his son. It is God's son. It is not significant that Jesus is referenced as the Son of God more than once. Because remember, I told you before, listen. Don't think I'm blasphemous for saying this. But you cannot use, I don't care who says it on this campus, I'm telling you so that you don't look foolish. You cannot use Son of God to argue for the divinity of Jesus, because that does not what that meant at all to the Jews. It's not what it meant. Am I saying Jesus is not God? No, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying whenever you're arguing for Jesus as God, do not use this. You will look foolish. Do you hear what I'm saying? Why? Because any historian worth his salt knows that the Son of God is used to reference the go-between between God and humanity, whether he is talking about a nation as his son or a king as his son. It is talking about the go-between God and his people. Kings were called sons of God. The nation of Israel is called sons of God. Are we saying that they are part of the Trinity too? No. Don't be foolish. Argue for the Trinity with different texts. Do not use this. You hear me? Please, as a historian, I'm begging you. Don't use this, okay? Because it makes us look like idiots, like we don't know what we're talking about, okay? So use the arguments that actually make sense so that then we cannot look foolish and actually argue for what we're trying to say. Fair enough? Side note done. Just trying to save us all some problems down the road. Okay, where are we at? What am I talking about? Hosea 11. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. But the more I called Israel, listen to this, Hosea 11 verse 2. But the more I called Israel, the further they went from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. You see what he's saying? They were my son. And it doesn't matter what I did, I even pulled them out of Egypt. And what did they do? Well, if you actually read the Exodus story, what do they do as soon as they get out of Exodus? As soon as they get out of Egypt, I mean. Well, first of all, we go into the wilderness and they're whining. Oh, man, we want some water. We want some food. What'd you do? Bring us out in the wilderness to die? I wish we were back in Egypt. You wish you were back in Egypt? Really? What is wrong with you? He can part the Red Sea. He can cause all these plagues, but he can't feed you? Are you that dense? Although, how many times has God done amazing things in your own life and the next day you forget about it? Well, he's never parted the Red Sea. No, he's probably done greater things than that. Because parting the Red Sea is a magic trick. Saving your soul is pretty cool. I take that over parting the Red Sea any day. But hey, let's go back to Egypt. We're safe there. I just want to be like the other nations. Because then the government can make me happy. I don't need God. I'll just rely on them to take his place. You see what they're saying? Out of Egypt I called my son, but the more I called Israel, the further they went from me. They sacrificed to the Baals, and they burned incense to images. Wish we weren't as dumb as them. That's more of a self-disclosure than anything else, but... Why is he quoting this for Jesus? Because Jesus is the true Israel. And he does match them on Hosea 11 verse 1, that out of Egypt I called my son. But he reverses verse 2, because he does not rebel against God. He is the true son. He doesn't worship idols. He doesn't go after the Baal images. He doesn't do that. What does he do? He succeeds where Israel fails. Because he is the true Israel. He is the true son. And from him comes fulfilled Israel. That should have an impact on the way in which we look at modern day nation of Israel today. That's right, I said it. Does that make sense? They don't get a free pass, friends. They're a mission field. They are lost without Jesus. And I refuse to support whatever they do just because they have the name Israel attached to them. Because they have hijacked that name from the fulfilled Israel, which is the church through Jesus, the true Israel. Sorry. Verse 16. We're going to finish today. In 9 minutes. We can do this. This is no problem. When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, those scallywags, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. When did he learn the time period from the Magi? In the secret meeting. Verse 7. They had a secret meeting, and he asked them at what time the star appeared. Once they give him the time frame, he knows it's about 2 years and under. That's who I have to target. Here's the question. How come we don't see this event where he's wiping out all the children in Israel under the age of two, men, boys? How come we don't see that in the Roman annals? How come we don't see that in Roman history?
They don't care.
Well, they maybe, yeah. Why don't they care?
It's just like 20 babies in a small Jewish town.
Exactly. Exactly. Bethlehem, at the time in which Jesus was born, would have been about 1,000. That means they would have maybe killed 10 to 30 boys, which means if Jesus was there, he couldn't have hidden. Right? You can't hide in a city of 1,000 when there's only 10 to 30 boys that are under the age of two. Can't happen. And for Romans, the Romans, who cares? We have more people die like that in a day on the frontiers. That's not going to make the headlines. It's going to devastate the city who has had an entire generation wiped out. But no one else in the city is going to, or no one else in the empire is going to care. So no, it's an insignificant people group, the Jews, who are nothing more than a thorn in the side of the empire. And it's only 10 or 30 of them. We're going to record things like the 3,000 executions that happened around the AD 66. That's what makes the headlines. So whether or not that's callous or not, that's the reason why it didn't make it into the history books. Let's keep reading. Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. Oh, there it is again. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel, weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. This comes from Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 15. But we need to look at some key images in this to understand what is actually happening. Number one, Ramah is the name of the city that the captives of Judah, which is the last group of the kingdom that has been taken into captivity, that is the place where Babylon takes them, is Ramah. And in Ramah, where the captives are all gathered together, you hear great weeping and mourning. Then you see the image of Rachel. Rachel weeping for her children. Rachel would not have been alive whenever Judah was taken into captivity, would she? Who is Rachel? Who is she the wife of? Think Genesis, eh?
Jacob.
And Rachel is the one through which the promise is traced. So he personifies Rachel weeping because, and she refuses to be comforted. Why? The last phrase. Because they are no more. Who is they? Who is they? I'm sorry, what? Who is she weeping over? Who is they that are no more? Think of the context of Ramah, the city.
Israel.
The nation, whenever it goes into captivity, Rachel is weeping because the promise that has come through her womb is no more. The people have been taken away. But verse 16 of Jeremiah 31. See, this comes from Jeremiah 31, 15. But Jeremiah 31, 16 and 17 is what I think Matthew is pointing at. Because it says this. This is what the Lord says. Restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work will be rewarded. Who is he speaking to? Rachel. Stop crying, Rachel. Your work will be rewarded, declares the Lord. They will return from the land of the enemy, so there is hope for your future, declares the Lord. Your children will return to their own land. It's just like the prophets. You talk about a judgment and you lead right into the promise. And I think here he's not talking so much about the judgment as he is the promise. Because even in the tragedy of Bethlehem, when it looks like all hope has been lost, what is he pointing to? Anybody know? I just read the passage in Jeremiah 31, 16. You cannot check out when we read the Old Testament. The promise. As a matter of fact, if you go down in Jeremiah and go to verse 31 of chapter 31. This is what it says. Now listen, this is the context of what he has quoted here in verse 18 of Matthew 2. Verse 31 of Jeremiah 31 says this. The time is coming, declares the Lord. Notice how many times declares the Lord is said. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I have made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt. Notice again. Because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them. That sounds like Hosea, right? But we're not in Hosea, we're in Jeremiah. Declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. That's Revelation 21. That's beautiful. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they all will know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. Why is he quoting Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 15 of Lamentation? Why is Matthew quoting the picture of the weeping in Ramah, the weeping of Rachel? Why is he quoting that? To point to the new covenant, that out of this tragedy, so will also be birthed the promise that Jeremiah was pointing to. You see what's happening? Okay, ultimately though this, Jesus fulfills both the Hosea passage and the Jeremiah passage. How much time do I have? Somebody give me a shout out. 5 minutes? 2 minutes? Awesome. We can do this. We can do this. Verse 19. After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." Who was trying to take the child's life? Herod. So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. When Herod died, he divvied up his region amongst three of his sons. I better look at my notes for this. I don't want to mess this up. Archelaus, yeah, was 19. And Archelaus took over this region, which is Samaria, Judea, and Idumea, which this is where Jerusalem is, which why they spelled it with a Z, I have no idea. This is what he took over at 19 years of age. But he has three sons, so he gives them three different sections. Archelaus takes that one. Herod Antipas, who is only 17 years old, takes over Galilee and Perea. Okay? So that's Herod Antipas. Is Herod Antipas important in the Gospel of Matthew? Yes. Why? Where is he going to pop up his head in his ugliness? John the Baptist. Yeah, matter of fact, in Luke's Gospel, Luke 23, Jesus actually goes before Herod Antipas as a trial in his crucifixion. Philip II, Philip the Tetrarch, is the other one that gets a part of the kingdom, and he gets Bethania, which is up here. Now, Herod Antipas, he will rule for 43 years. He'll rule from 4 BC to about 39 BC, or 39 AD, excuse me. He goes backwards. Archelaus, though, only rules for 10 years. Because Archelaus is so vicious. Archelaus, there's actually an account of Archelaus. There's an uprising at a Passover festival. Why would there be an uprising at a Passover festival?
The festival of the liberation.
Yeah. It's the festival that's celebrating the liberation, the exodus from oppression. There's an uprising. What does he do? He sends in his troops and they wipe out 3,000 Jews. If I have a minute, I'll get your question, but I got to keep moving. I'm sorry. Basically, Augustus was so afraid that Archelaus would incite a major riot that he had Archelaus removed in 6 AD and banished to Gaul. From that point on, his regions, which were Samaria, Judea, and Idumea, were ruled by Roman prefects, one of which was a man by the name of Pontius Pilate. See how that happens? That happens in 6 AD, not Pontius Pilate. He doesn't happen until, I think, well, we'll get to that later. I think it's 16 to 26 or something like that. Anyway, okay, we got to keep reading. Sorry. We're going to finish this. So we got to chapter. Blah, 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 blah. Having been warned in a dream, he, Joseph, withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was said to the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene." Give me one more minute. So was fulfilled to the prophets, "He will be called a Nazarene." We do not know the source of this, but there is a theory. The theory is this, that it's probably, possibly, a word, Hebrew word play from Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. In Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1, it says this. It says, "A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse." What is that talking about? A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. Who is Jesse? David's father. What is the shoot that will come up from the stump of Jesse? The Messiah, coming from the lineage of David. Come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. In Hebrew, the word for branch is nezer. The idea is when the people that settled in Nazareth, that they were of the lineage of David. And to commemorate the fact that their hope was in the coming Messiah that would come from their lineage, they named their city Nazareth or Nezareth. The branch, the city from the branch of the stump of Jesse. So the idea would be that Jesus comes from the place that is looking for the hope of a liberating king. He grows up in that place. All of this to say this, really quick. What I want you to get from today's lecture is this. Listen very carefully. You can pack up in 1 second if I can finish this in 10. Even at Jesus' birth, even when he's a little child, he is a political threat. So much so that even as a baby, he has to be pursued in order to be killed because of what he brings to this world. And that's something we'll be tracing throughout the rest of Matthew. Cool? We are caught up. Love you guys. See you tomorrow morning.